From Paul's house and Storm's house, it's Paul and Storm talk about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes, on average.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The stars at night are big and bright. I'm Paul. You know, you're always supposed to finish that part. That's okay. I should have realized you were going to automatically finish it, so let's do it proper. The stars at night are big and bright.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
I'm Paul.
I'm Storm.
And we're going to talk about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes,
on average.
Today it is, frankly, I have no idea in the world what day it is.
It's Wednesday, November 3rd,
2010.
And this is show 100.
Yeah!
100th podcast.
Awesome. We are in a car. Technically, we're in a minivan. We're in a moving vehicle driving from Austin to Dallas. Awesome! There's totally a building on the side of the road that looks like a spaceship.
It looks like something out of the original Battlestar Galactica.
Yep, it's Starship Pegasus food and gifts and stuff. It's tourist trap.
So that tells you exactly what's happening here. Basically, we're in the middle of nowhere, Texas, nearly to Dallas, so not entirely nowhere. Towards the end of this Woodstock run, I guess it's been 2 weeks since our last podcast, and we have been having a heck of a run. I gotta say, I really miss that Will Wheaton is not on this run. We've been having fun. It would have been extra fun, but part of the fun is in the van with us right now.
That's right. We have, for our special guests on this podcast, very good friend, songwriter, singer, Ukulatrix, Molly Lewis.
Hi, everybody. Yay, it's me.
And her fella, Chris Wright.
Hi, everybody.
Yay! We're all very happy and friendly here in this podcast.
Let's take care of the business.
Oh, yes, let's do that.
We currently have 371 minions in the Paul and Storm Brigade of Minions. Go to paulandstorm.com to find out how to join, because you want to and you'll be entitled to all of the benefits and privileges that minionhood confers.
Molly is a minion. Molly was like our second
minion
or something.
Three,
yeah, you're very early. Chris, are you a minion
yet? I'm not a minion. I hate these guys.
You're a minion by proxy. Okay, so there's the business. Hang on, I'm getting some texts, so talk about some stuff.
Yeah, so basically we've been on the road, and we feel bad we haven't dished you some cast lately, as they say in the biz, or now they do. Anyway, but I'm driving. I literally have two hands on the wheel, have not been able to prepare any notes, so I think there might be a lot of boring shouted out.
That's okay. We put out the call on Twitter. And there were a lot of suggestions regarding traveling, and seeing as we are in a moving vehicle, I think that's a good general theme for the show.
Yeah, seeing as I'm driving, Paul, you have the con for this.
All right, I have the con. Well, let's start with something that somebody recommended. I do not remember who, because my laptop is closed. Talking about travel games. Travel games that you played driving in the car growing up, or even as the grown-ups that you are right now. For example, we're driving through Texas, and we've heard Molly and Chris do a lot of the, as soon as we pass any pasture with cows in it, they have to shout out, cows!
And punch.
And punch. There's a punch.
If she keeps punching me, I should comment, because she's abusive.
Yeah,
if anyone in protective services hear this.
No, I'm just very competitive when it comes to cows. Cows.
I don't think it has anything to do with the game. I think it's about the punching.
I think you're right. But that's a thing. Like,
just like Slugbug is not really about the car. It's
yeah.
about punching.
Yeah, you're just playing Slug Cow.
I'm playing Slug Cow, yeah.
Now, here's the thing. Is it a natural human proclivity to
punch other people?
No, not
yes.
punch other people. Well, that's certainly a natural human proclivity. But there's something certainly about all of my urban and suburban friends. When you pass a pasture full of cows, somebody has to make note of it. Often it involves looking out the window and going moo at the cows.
Yeah.
But I've noticed that certainly when I was younger, and even to this day, I get. It's not much of a thrill, but it's still a tiny little sort of lizard brain thrill seeing a pasture filled with cows when I pass by.
I'm sorry. I'm so deeply suburban that I get excited when I see squirrels. Like, there were not squirrels in my neighborhood, and so when I see one on campus, I'm like, squirrel, guys, you see, squirrel.
So you're like Doug the dog.
Pretty much, yeah.
I think it's the hunter-gatherer instinct. Like, intellectually, we know these are cows in a pasture that some agribusiness owns, but that part of you that's out in the woods and is hungry and hasn't eaten for a week is like, fuck yeah, cow. I'm gonna put a stick into that and eat it.
I'm gonna put a stick into that as the first front-runner for the title of this particular podcast, I think. It's not a super strong one, but it's a good start.
I also like slug cows.
Slug cows is good. Yeah, okay. We got a couple of front-runners.
So was the whole question just what games do you play?
Just asking about traveling games. Now, here's another question. Are you guys pro-I Spy or anti-I Spy?
I'm anti-I Spy, because especially in a moving car, because by the time you guess, it might be behind you.
That's true.
I'm pro-I Spy, so this might cause a rift in our relationship.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a good traveling game. I think it's a good, like, airport terminal kind of game.
Yeah, I prefer it with people. It's a form of people watching, I think.
I'm actually anti-car game. To me, when playing car games makes the trip last, like, 80 times longer, because it actually engages your mind versus, like, zoning out and just driving really fast.
You're playing the wrong car games.
Yeah, I don't know. It makes the trip longer. For me, especially if you're somewhere like the middle of nowhere, Texas, the point is just
getting through it.
Yeah, just be somewhere else.
Now, does that make a difference to you whether you're driving or not driving?
One thing is, if I'm driving, with the exception of podcasts, I tend to dedicate my attention 100% to driving.
I don't mind car games. I mean, I've got kids, so we used to play them quite a bit. We don't really do them so much anymore. My kids play a game that I had never heard of until they started playing it with me. Now I can't remember the name of it, but basically when you saw a yellow car, you'd hit each other, and if you saw a yellow car that was a convertible, you'd hit each other twice. Spot, that's what they would call it. If you saw a yellow car, you'd shout out spot.
See, I think this leads to just looking for excuses to punch each other.
I know, we're back to punching again, I see.
You need input.
I wonder
if, like, being restrained into a chair sort of brings out the urge to punch somebody because they can't run from you.
It could be. Even further than that, I'm wondering, we can ask if we have any foreign listeners. Feel free to send in comments and let us know. Is this a uniquely American thing, both because American culture is so centered around driving.
Vodka!
Storm has punched me in the Spanish style. But since, you know, our culture is focused around driving, we're so much more spread out than Europe, so we drive a lot more and more distances.
Yeah, does it work on trains? Like, if you're on a long train trip and you see a field full of cows, do you get the same thrill? I don't know, Molly, Chris, have you done train trips like that?
Not recently.
No. I've done a few, and I think it's sort of just generally traveling is kind of an unpleasant experience. It should be really pleasant, but if you're in a plane or a car, it's uncomfortable, and it's long, and you don't want to be there, so you kind of want to punch someone to get your aggression out. But on a train, it's a really relaxing experience. You have a lot of room, and there's pleasant scenery generally, and I think you're just kind of more serene, so you don't have the urge on the train.
You don't need to notice the cows.
Yeah, and it's not any particular grand insight to say that the rise of portable computing devices and smartphones, I think, has to a great degree, I would bet, killed the car game culture above a certain age.
It's starting to rain pretty friggin' hard.
It is starting to rain pretty hard.
What's our next question here?
Our next question, let's see, what is the longest trip you have ever taken in a car? With family or by yourself?
Well, I think I should answer this one, because how I met Molly is that a friend of mine was going to this YouTube gathering in Portland and Twittered about it, and I said, oh, well, you're fancy, it's going to be fun, and he invited me to go on about 2 hours' notice, and so I decided at about 11 o'clock at night to drive from Los Angeles to Bakersfield, where I then spent about 2 hours just meandering around Bakersfield at 2 a.m, waiting for my friends from Vegas to show up, and then we all met up and we drove to Portland nonstop, most of which was spent by me alone in a car while they were all asleep through the middle of the night. And it was its own kind of zen. I was just eating sunflower seeds to keep myself awake.
Sure.
And just kind of...
Is that a thing? I've never heard of, like, the sunflower seed Vivarin
There's
technique.
Actually, on the back of the sunflower seed bag, they have instructions for how to, like, store a zillion sunflower seeds in one cheek and transfer them to the other so that you can drive and eat sunflower seeds.
And it's perfect because it's just enough sort of physical and mental activity to keep you awake, but it's not enough to distract you at all. And it actually works 10 times better than caffeine for me.
We're driving through a town called Waxahachie right now.
Oh, Texas.
Hello, Waxahachie, Texas. How about you, Storm? What is the longest trip you've taken by car?
It depends how you count it. When me and Mrs. Storm did our Southwest trip, it was an awful lot of driving. But I'd say, like, I'm gonna limit it to our single longest drive.
Like from one place to place two?
Well, in one day, which was the Da Vinci's Notebook trip, where we went from St. Louis all the way home. And that was an overnighter.
Yeah, that's true. Was that longer than, I guess that was longer than...
Atlanta?
No, I was thinking of, where were we in Kentucky? Was it Louisville?
Oh yeah. St. Louis is way farther than...
Yeah, I suppose you're right. Yeah, you guys, that was great. You and Richard, one of our bandmates from Da Vinci's Notebook, decided to drive home from Louisville, Kentucky one night, whereas Bernie, our other bandmate, and I slept in and took an early flight. And you guys actually got home about an hour and a half sooner than we did.
Yeah, we were smoking through West Virginia. Like, we used to have this big disco conversion van that had just enough of an engine in it to hit warp speed every now and then, at least going downhill.
Let's see. How about train trips? Anyone ever taken a family train trip of other
travel.
Than, like... No, come on. This is interesting. I wanted to talk about the train because it's such a dying thing. Not an art, but for lack of a better phrase, a dying art in America. Any of you taken any good lengthy train trips?
When I was little, my brother David had this kind of fascination with just trains, and he would, like, wear the full-on, like, conductor, like, overalls and the little hat.
How old were they at the time?
He was, I want to say he was, like, 5.
Oh, okay. If he was, like, you know, 17.
Not like 17, and... No. But we would go to Anaheim. There's a train station right by Angel Stadium. And we would take the train into San Juan Capistrano and just go to the mission and, like, you know, get lunch and then get back on the train. And it was, I don't even know how long it was, but it wasn't very long at all. And it was just for riding the train. The stopping in San Juan Capistrano was kind of secondary.
Why is a train more interesting than a bus? Like, I'm a huge train fan. I believe we went over this a few podcasts ago. I even consider myself something of a train buff. Not extreme. I guess we already talked about that, though. Just the idea that it doesn't stop, and something about these rails that are continuous.
You know what it is?
What's that?
It's the continuous rails, and it's the chugga-chugga.
Yeah.
Well, I guess they do chugga-chugga.
Well, you know, you don't hear the chugga-chugga of the steam engine, but just the steady thrum of train wheels.
And the mechanisms of a bus are kind of familiar. It's just really a big, glorified car with, you know, several seats and windows, but... A train has these big visible, like, gears, and it has these big metal wheels and these things that spin, which is, you know, fascinating to a 5-year-old boy, but it's just so kind of different from anything that we drive on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've romanticized trains in a way we didn't really romanticize cars, because we have, like, the Murder on the Orient Express, and we have all these sort of stories and things set in kind of, like, the golden era of train travel, when it was kind of, it was about half.
That's true. There's not a lot of murder mysteries set on a bus, are there?
No, but there's Smokey and the Bandit and Cannonball Run.
Okay.
Two
literary classics, certainly.
Yes. But that's kind of different, because that's, like, about the independent nature of, like, Cannonball people. But, like, all these other train stories, it's sort of about... It's kind of like that nostalgia for a different era that everyone always feels about the generation before.
And, like, when the train tracks were put down, everyone was like, oh, crap, we can go to the other side of the country and not be a completely different person by the time we get there.
And, like, the meeting of the two halves of the trains.
Like Old Spike and all, yeah.
Yep.
And I guess the whole actually being able to get up, walk around, you can put on a tuxedo and a top hat in a train.
There's a little dining car and you can...
We can't do that in this minivan. None of us are wearing a top hat right now.
No, and unfortunately there's not even one to access that
guys,
we could be wearing.
We could have just said that we were all wearing top hats and it's a podcast and they would have believed us.
Oh, too late.
No, we stand on honesty in our podcast. We have no fake monocles in our podcast. I don't know about your little podcast, Molly and Chris.
Fake monocles is a front runner now, too.
Yeah. And it's also the name of my... Come on, come up with a good one, somebody.
You opened that.
I opened it, but I can't close the deal.
Whatever the guy from Pumpkin Heroes is.
Yes, my Werner Klimper, the cover band.
Yeah. All those bands that he was in.
Yes, he was such the musician.
All right, what you got that's not about travel?
What have I got that's not about travel? Okay, Mr. Boardy Board.
Boring.
I don't know, you guys think of a good topic. Something. I know, okay, I'll open up the thing here.
What do the internets want to find
drivety,
out
drivety.
About?
The internets want to find out about Molly punching my nuts, which won't make sense to anyone who wasn't following our Twitter feed today. Okay. Here's one. Here, let's talk about a little bit about California culture, something that fascinated me. At the Los Angeles Woodstock, which Molly was at, Chris Hardwick, at one point in the night, making a joke, saying something about being trapped, I think it was in the middle of The Captain's Wife's Lament, he started going into part of the narration from The Haunted Mansion.
Yes.
And everybody in the audience chanted along word for word. The one where you're in the room that is slowly stretching.
Doorless chambers and strange and frightening sounds echo through the halls. Wherever candlelights flicker, where the air is deathly still, that is the time when ghosts are present, practicing their terror with ghoulish delight. Welcome, foolish mortals, to the Haunted Mansion. I am your host, your ghost host. Kindly step all the way in, please, and make room for everyone. There's no turning back now. Your cadaverous pallor betrays an aura of foreboding, almost as though you sense it is quieting metamorphosis. Is this haunted room actually stretching, or is it your imagination, And consider this dismaying observation. This chamber has no windows and no doors, which offers you this chilling challenge to find a way out, evil actor that I can't imitate. Of course, there's always my way. Dead guy hanging from the ceiling. Everything goes dark. Everyone screams. Elevator doors open, and you're on the ride.
Yay!
$24,000.
So it was something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like, I guess you and I, Paul and I, we've been at the Haunted Mansion at one point, but it's not quite as ingrained.
Yeah,
I guess it's proximity.
You grew up in Anaheim or near Anaheim, right?
It was essentially my backyard. Like, we bought my first Disneyland pass when I was two, and my mom counted, and between my second and third birthday, we went to Disneyland 33 times.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I know.
That's sort of like the equivalent of most families have a few Disney DVDs that get played again and again. You know, show Nemo again. And I guess you would just saunter down the street and revisit the Haunted Mansion. Clearly. I mean, I'm pretty sure you...
They would just sit me in the lobby, and they would go ride rides and stuff, and I would just sit in my stroller and just watch the elevator go up and down.
As far as your experience, is that a relatively common thing for people who live in that area? Do you get tired of Disney at a certain point?
Well, when I was in middle school, I totally went through a phase where I was like, God, all the rides are the same. Why do we keep having back? You know, a single day park hopping ticket is like $90, but a pass is almost $300. And so after you go three times, it's paid for itself.
Yeah.
And if you bring in your own food, then it's just candy.
You bring in your own food?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
You can't. If you hide firearms at the bottom of your bag, you could bring those in too, in theory, but they don't stop you for food.
Let me ask this. On the last leg of the tour, which seems like about a billion years ago, Marion Call was on the trip. She is from Alaska.
Yeah.
She had never been east before. And she was blown away by, like, D.C. and New York, and it seemed funny to me, but how old things seemed. Now, you being a Californian, born and raised, do you get that sense as well, like, when you're in older cities? To our European and U.K. Listeners, this sounds very funny to you, you know. But sort of what's your sense of time and scale when it comes to history and geography?
I don't know, because we studied the missions, and like the missions are pretty much the oldest buildings in California, but I'm not sure actually how old they are, because I didn't really pay attention in that unit. But like,
they're pretty old.
Yeah.
They are pretty old, but the thing is, in the West, it wasn't really settled until relatively recently.
Yeah.
And by the time it was settled, we've gotten to the mentality where we pretty much just knock everything down every 20 years.
Right.
And that's not how it used to be. And it does feel completely different when you go to the East Coast, even though it's not that old compared to where it was.
And because of that, do you feel drawn to that, or is it just something that's kind of part of the scenery? Like, Do you feel like you are more interested in buildings and places that are old, or is it just, that's old?
I sort of feel like, I don't know if I'm making this up or if this is actually true, but, like, it seems like in California we don't really invest our history in buildings. So, like, we have, like, in Hollywood there's, like, the Capitol Records building, and there's...
Yeah.
But in Hollywood there are so many, like, well, this is where this thing was shot, and this thing was filmed in front of this building, and if we had to preserve all of those buildings and everything where anything has ever been shot, then nothing would ever get rebuilt.
Right.
And, like, at Disneyland, they have a finite amount of real estate, and so they have to periodically take things out and replace them with, like, with new things. And so Circle Vision got replaced by this Buzz Lightyear thing, and it's kind of... You sort of have to accept that it's the march of progress, and we have a lot of real estate in California, but we only stay in this very kind of condensed
little
pocket.
Yeah, the 30-square-mile area or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Right, the Sierras aren't going to flatten themselves out anytime soon. Sierra Nevadas, that is.
Right.
Living Mountains.
Yeah, you're talking about the beers?
Yes, the beers aren't going to flatten themselves anytime.
They will if you open the cap.
You gotta open it first and
shake. Okay, so we talked to California. Let me look here, okay, here's a question from Cube Steve. Who is cuter, Molly23 or that would be, of course, Molly's Twitter account. Who is cuter, Molly or a cartoon bunny version of Molly?
Oh, gosh.
Is there a demonstration?
There is not a sample. We just have to imagine our own cartoon bunny.
Yeah, are we in this... we can't ask you, are we in the cartoon realm or are we in the real realm? That's the thing.
That's a good question. Plus, since you didn't provide a sample, we're coming up with our own cartoon bunny, and you can always come up with a cartoon bunny that is more adorable than any actual thing.
And personally...
The Twilight Zone episode, the Eye of the Beholder, where if, like, real Molly's in the cartoon world, then I would be just hideous.
Yeah.
Like, if I were to draw it, my subconscious tends to do that kind of horror bunny thing. So I'm going to say real Molly is cuter.
Yeah, you know what? I'm there too. Because
we have a concrete idea of what real Molly looks like. We don't know anything about this cartoon.
Exactly. Don't bother us with abstractions, people.
That's right. It's Schrodinger's Molly.
Here's a question from Where I Am... Where Am I 89 asking, what is our favorite thing audiences do at our concerts or other concerts?
Throw $100 bills.
That's awesome. I'm always a fan of that.
Love that. Molly,
you're an increasingly seasoned performer, but still relatively new, you know, compared to, say, our years of road-hardened experience. Have you noticed any tendencies in your audience that you particularly enjoy or that particularly surprise you?
I gotta think about that one a bit. Chris, what's your favorite thing that people do when you're on stage?
Oh, man. They notice that something's gone wrong because I'm running out on stage fixing things.
Well, here's something, actually. We were talking about this last night with our close personal friend Adam Savage after the show.
Of Mythbusters.
Of Mythbusters, yes, the guy on the TV. And we were talking about how, and this is long ago this surprised me, and then it stopped surprising me, how... Audiences at our shows, like at a Colton show and at a Paul and Storm show or a Woodstock, they seem to particularly enjoy it when we screw up.
Yeah.
Like we miss a lyric or screw up a chord and actually physically have to stop. Colton's really good at that. He's good for two or three of those in an evening often, because he's not professional. But the audience absolutely loves it. And I don't think you see that. You know, if like you two fucked up and had to stop a song, there'd be rioting. Or like Guns N' Roses or Van Halen, to say their pre-recorded music plays step too high.
They can't stop. If they do, it would show it to be the, well, not a farce, but just the necessity of filling out all the parts.
And my personal theory on that is because those type of shows, they really are just sort of productions and spectacles.
Yes.
They're like genuinely three-dimensional movies and live experiences, whereas...
It's what they call a rock show.
Yeah, a rock show. It's mostly one-directional,
yes.
If not entirely one-directional, which is as much as anything a function of the size of the crowd. Like, you can't interact with a stadium full of people.
And a Woodstock or a Paul and Storm or Jonathan Colton show is omnidirectional. And those of you who've come out to the shows know that. It's all about the everything. Another thing I do love, for seriously, besides the $100 bills, is when people are singing along, like not to the point that it's louder than us, but when you look out and you see people clearly knowing what the music is, it still blows my mind.
That is incredibly flattering, I will certainly say that. I've seen it here and there, first time ever, and we see it a lot with Jonathan. obviously he's got, you know, a number of sort of nerd anthems between Still Alive and Skullcrusher Mountain, where he gets the sing-along thing happening a lot. First time it really hit home for me was when the first time we played PAX in Seattle, and it had a thrust stage where there was a little sort of runway out into the stage, and we went out to sing Live, and the whole crowd around us was singing along with us, and that was really sort of a new experience for me.
A place we'd never been with a crowd like that, and we had people singing, but not to that concentrated degree.
And so that was pretty awesome. I mean, you know, I always make a joke.
What's our next direction?
What's our next direction? Molly, talk about something while I give our next direction.
Well.
And stuff. I had an idea for what my favorite thing about live performing is, but I don't remember now.
Your audience recognizes things.
It always wins me over when there's like some surly, you know, 15-year-old who's texting at the beginning of my set, and at the end he's paying attention.
Yeah, gotcha. You know, won them over.
Gotcha.
And I guess one thing, if we're going to go on the why it's charming when you guys screw up, is that, like, Colton and a lot of the Woodstock people, they're sort of more homemade, and they're kind of just more, like, they come from areas that you feel like you've gotten to know them in a more personal way. Like, you two and all these bands are just big rock star acts. Colton got to start on the internet, and Molly's done YouTube videos, and it's just something where you feel like you've invited them into your lives, and they're non-professional.
It's intimate.
Yeah, it's intimate. So when they screw up, it's just like you're seeing the real them, and it's just kind of, it's
because you get to watch them get flustered. They don't get to be like the sort of polished rock star. It's, you know, they're a real person, which is sort of why you attach onto them in the first place.
Right. We're not pedestal people here, you know?
Pedestal people is a good front runner for this podcast name as well. Hold on, I'm going to pull open my laptop and find another topic.
Yeah, good questions, people.
Yes, these are some excellent questions. Hey, we've been recording for 26 minutes. This is pretty sweet.
Say, respectable. We haven't crashed yet into anything physically with the vehicle.
Parts.
Yeah, knock on parts.
Knock on.
Another off-putting thing, speaking of name-dropping, Molly has a song, for those of you who have not heard it, about wanting to bear Stephen Fry's child. Which is a very charming and clever and wonderful song. And now, as I understand it, Stephen Fry has actually heard this song?
He has. I think it was actually because I played it for the first time at Woodstock Seattle, and then the next day at Woodstock Portland, Adam said, you know, I actually have a friend who knows Stephen Fry. Is there a video up? Should I send it? And I was like, yeah, why don't you do that? And if I remember correctly, because I was forwarded on Mr. Fry's response, and I think his exact words were, bless my blimey, how very sweet. I'm almost tempted to take her up on the offer, ..
Oh, those ellipses. They say so much.
And I should also, because I want to name drop on behalf of her, but she won't, the email, the friend that Adam had that was the intermediary was Craig Ferguson.
Which Adam didn't actually tell me. I found out through somebody on Twitter who was like, oh, I tried to send this to Stephen Fry, but he said, oh yeah, Craig Ferguson showed me this yesterday. And I went back to Adam and I was like, what? Why didn't you tell me?
So you won't really be surprised if you receive in a small brown cardboard box, a test tube, a vial. You're prepared for that.
I'm going to take steps to make sure it is Stephen Fry's.
Yeah, that would be a good idea. Yeah. Confirmation, it will be required.
Yeah. Just twin pick him a picture of the box. Is this from you, signed? Sent from my iPhone.
It's a picture, a twin pic of you holding it.
Yeah.
Do they have sperm sommeliers?
Sperm sommeliers is a runner-up for the name of this podcast.
I will be your sperm steward for the evening.
One of these days, I'm going to get really drunk behind the scenes at Woodstock, and when Molly's playing Stephen Fry, I'm just going to shout with, my boyfriend is willing to help. I'm just going to say, I'll be the fluffer!
Fluffer boyfriend. The thing is, there's a line in the song where it says, I have permission from my boyfriend, and he'd like to help you out. And I just meant, like, he's willing to offer his girlfriend to, because he likes
right. Sure, you did.
But, yeah, and people laugh at that, which I don't intend. I don't know how to change it, though.
Don't change a thing.
I'm fine with this.
We would we would put that song at the end of this podcast, except she hasn't recorded it yet.
I can record it onto this thing.
You probably could. Is your ukulele handy? Chris is going to get. We're going to do this live. This is always this warts and all.
Why don't we wrap up the podcast?
Yeah, we'll do that, and then we'll have Molly play live from the rear passenger seat of our...
Minivan down by the river.
Minivan.
So coming up, we're going to be, after we finish up with this last Woodstock tonight in Dallas, we are going to be on the road with Jonathan Cole.
Well, first we're going to be at the Lincoln Theater, or excuse me, Lincoln Hall in Chicago, along with Peter Sagal on November 15th, which I believe is a Monday night. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Peter, Paul, and Storm.
Peter, Paul, and Storm. Had to name it that. No choice. And then we got two dates with Jonathan Colton in December. I believe it's the first and second, or second and third, or something like that, in Raleigh and Atlanta. You can check our website to find those specific dates.
Also go to the website to find out to become part of the Paul and Storm Brigade of Minions, ramping up to 400 strong.
Wow. Yeah, I know. And it's also worth mentioning, of course, the Joko Cruise Crazy Jonathan Colton Fan Club Cruise.
Molly will be on that as well. Yeah.
Molly will be traveling and performing on that.
Peter Sagal and John Hodgman and Mike Furman.
And Will Wheaton and Paul F. Tompkins and John Roderick and a bunch of awesome people. It's getting close.
It is.
A couple of months away. Holy shit.
What's our next direction?
Our next direction is... He said, clicking on his phone, bring the map up. Oh, this is some stellar radio right here. Exit 429A towards US 75.
Got it. Okay. So that's the rundown.
Excuse me, he said. There's the remnants of my cold.
Yeah, which I've picked up.
And it's worth saying again, because we haven't really been twittering a lot on this trip about it, a huge thank you to everyone who came out to all the Woodstocks over the past week. It's just been a great experience. This is the first real tour of Woodstock, and it's been phenomenal all the way around.
And thank you to our emergency backup, Wills, and to the Woodstock guests. And we can say it personally, thank you, Molly, for being part of
Woodstock. On behalf of all the guests, it's always great to have you on the show.
You're welcome, on behalf of everybody.
So, with that being said,
well, I'm Storm.
And I'm Paul.
And we've been talking about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes.
On average. Her eyes are bright as diamonds, they sparkle like the dew.
Go do things.
Now we present Molly Lewis.
Is this going to be audible?
We'll see, and if it's not, we'll re-record it later.
Okay. Should I explain it?
Go ahead, give a title and an explanation.
Okay. So this song is, I wrote it because I'm from the YouTubes, and the highest compliment that you can pay somebody on the YouTubes is to tell them that you want to have their babies. And, you know, being female, I assume that most of the men who tell me this, they mean it figuratively, but the song isn't about that. I mean it literally, and I mean it to Stephen Fry, who cannot have babies on his own because he's a man and he's a homosexual. And so, should he decide to ever have babies, this song is offering myself to the cause, and it's called An Open Letter to Stephen Fry. Is promised to a man, and so I have no hope to win it. But consider my proposal, sir, if you can find a minute. I think the future of our species would be better with you in it. I know you have your problems, and maybe I have mine, but you should leave someone to carry on when you have turned to dust. time, please.
She faltered a little bit in the middle. That's so charming.
It's because Storm drove over a bump.
No, it's because you're not a pillar, people.